Hi everyone, it's Cynthia Dearen here. I am super excited to let you know that throughout the month of March, to coincide with International Women's Day, we're launching the Girls Go Global campaign. And we're going to be awarding a full scholarship to the International Business Accelerator to one lucky female entrepreneur. I created the IBA to help micro to medium-sized businesses to speed up and de-risk the process of taking a company international. And along the way, I've realized that there are not very many women on the international business scene, given the number of companies that are out there. And I don't think that's right. So I'm on a mission to change it. What we're going to be doing is awarding one female business owner a full scholarship to the program to give her all the tools she needs to make her business an international success. We'll also follow her journey and let you know how she goes. To celebrate the competition and to help spread the word, I'll be interviewing a very successful female entrepreneur every week throughout the month of March on the Business Beyond Borders podcast. My guests will be sharing their insights about the highs and lows of taking a business international, and we'll be talking about the challenges that they faced that their male counterparts didn't have to deal with. We'll also be talking about where they get their inspiration from and their top tips for success. The International Business Accelerator is a digital program, so it and the scholarships are open to anyone anywhere in the world, although if you are applying for a scholarship, I would suggest that it's probably better if you are a woman. If you're a female founder or you know someone who fits the bill, please visit our website to find out more and put your application in. Just go to internationalbusinessaccelerator.com/girls-go-global. Check it out. Hi there, and welcome back to the Business Beyond Borders podcast. I'm Cynthia Dearen, and on this show, I interview entrepreneurs who've become internationally successful about why and how they did it. My guest today is Alethea Navarro, CEO and founder at Skimlinks, a London-based tech company which specializes in automated affiliate marketing and facilitates around $1 billion of sales through their platform each year. I describe Alethea as a super smart, super personable geek girl and a born serial entrepreneur. She won a university medal in computing, but instead of becoming a corporate gun, she started her own thing a number of times. Alethea is fast-paced, she's flexible, and she's resilient. When things get tough, she takes a different direction, but she never gives up. And Alethea doesn't see being female as any kind of impediment to her success. I was really inspired and humbled to hear Alethea talk about building her company, starting while she was living out of a suitcase in London, and where she's taken Skimlinks from there. There are just so many relevant and pithy bits to this interview. I can't even list them all out here in the introduction, but I'd say that it's essential listening for anyone, male or female, who's on the entrepreneurial journey. Don't miss it. Tune in to catch this episode. So, Alethea, it's great to have you on the show today.
Lovely to be here, Cynthia.
I want to know, did you always think that you'd be an entrepreneur?
Do you know, I did. I'm one of those odd creatures that it had been my dream. Well, I wanted to be a spaceship captain and an air traffic control pilot or a businesswoman, because back then I didn't know the word entrepreneur. So it seems like I was, you know, always destined to boss people around, basically.
And why was that, do you think?
I think I was always a geek. It's funny because I think there's so much of a push to try to get women into technology as if it doesn't naturally come to them. But, you know, my sister and I were brought up in the same way, but I was just drawn to technology. And when we bought a Commodore 64 for the family, I'm the one that just dived into it and taught myself how to code at like 10 years old. Whenever we, you know, my parents had leftover long toilet roll, I would turn it into, you know, a She-Ra sword and run around my backyard pretending to press the buttons, or I'd create spaceship control things out of arts and crafts. I don't know, I just was drawn to the idea that you could deal with problems and challenges by being calm and being a leader. I think probably because I loved books and fiction and fairy tales. And so I was always drawn to this idea of being the hero, and a hero, you know, took control of situations. And many of the books that I was reading growing up were set in a kind of sci-fi fantasy world. And so technology kind of naturally started to form a part of that.
So your career choice was kind of informed by the fact that you like to be in control. Do you think that's fair?
I don't think that was a conscious choice, but now on retrospective reflection, it seems that it is a commonality amongst all the ambitions I had as a child.
All right. So I know that a little later on, when you were a teenager, you were part of a thing called Young Achievers. And for people who don't know what that is, I think it'd be fair to say it's an organization that teaches and mentors young people to help them create their own businesses. Would that be fair?
Yeah, the young people get put into teams, and then they go through the complete life cycle of starting, running, and then in the end dissolving a company and distributing the proceeds to investors. And so, you know, I did that as a very geeky, nerdy, shy girl, got voted to be managing director of my little company, which no one had ever voted for me. I was not a popular child. And then, you know, we came up with business idea, which was my initial idea, which was lip gloss, and we manufactured it and sold it to both men and women.
What did you make the lip gloss out of?
Just Vaseline with coloring and scent, basically.
Okay.
And we won. We made the most profit in the year, and we won Venture of the Year, and that was kind of the start of my addiction with entrepreneurship.
And so how do you think Young Achievers influenced what you went on to do?
I think it gave me a taste of the fact that I didn't have to be the popular blonde girl at school to be good at being a leader, and that being a leader didn't mean actually bossing people around. What I did as a leader was always set the example. So if there was going to be a weekend where we were manufacturing the lipstick, lip gloss, I was the first one in and the last one out. I was the one working the hardest. I was the one doing the grimiest jobs, because that's what a leader does. And that really sort of showed me the kind of leader I wanted to be.
Now, these days you run Skimlinks, but Skimlinks was not your first business. Is that right? I mean, apart from lip gloss, there are a couple of things that came before Skimlinks. So can you tell me, you did Young Achievers, fast forward, I believe you did computing science and you won the university medal. What happened after that, and what businesses did you start?
I mean, many. It's funny to kind of look back and recognize these kind of patterns retrospectively. But yeah, I was a fountain of ideas, and some of them I would follow through with more than others. So for a while, I started Head and Holidays, which was clubbing holidays to Ibiza from Australia, which very quickly I realized that unless you have a travel agent's license and a lot of capital, that was never going to work as a business. And it was just something I enjoyed at the time. And then I started Fun and Fearless Computing, which was complete computing solutions for senior citizens, which it turns out, again, I had no money, no knowledge of how to market anything. And after 3 months of working on it full time, I haven't quit my job to do this. I recognized that I didn't know enough or have enough capital to make that a success. And what I always seem to do is whenever I'd fail at a business idea is I'd go, right, well, what was the skill that I was lacking? And then I would get a job that would expose me to the skills that would fill that gap. So I just kind of kept trying, and there was a ton of other ideas that I kind of played around with even without quitting my job. It's still something I do today. Like, there's nothing more fun for me than coming up with an idea and writing a kind of high-level business plan.
So you are a classic entrepreneur, always coming up with the next, idea. Now, so tell me, Skimlinks was almost something else, and that became Skimlinks. Is that right?
Yeah, well, Skimlinks was the third pivot of a business I started. So basically, when I started this company, it began as a social shopping site. So something very similar to Pinterest, before Pinterest. Not as pretty as Pinterest, in fact, reasonably ugly. So I built that with a team of developers that I hired in Romania while I was in Sydney at the time. And
how did you do that? How did you find Romania? What year was this?
This was 2006.
And were Romanian developers the thing that they are now? Because, I mean, now anybody can go and pick up a Romanian developer by going to Freelancer or Upwork. But 2006, how did you actually do that?
There was the equivalent site at the time, but this particular company was used by a good friend of mine who now, of course, is my co-founder. So he had used this company for another one of his projects and introduced us. So it was a personal recommendation. And at the time I was working full time, so I'd basically go home at night and Romania was just waking up. So I would work from 8 p.m. till midnight every night, and then I'd work weekends. And I did that for about a year. And then eventually I had this kind of website. It was called Skimbit, which is a terrible name. And that it was time to do something about it, like raise money, or, you know, I had no more money left to do this on my own. So I tried to get Australian VCs to invest in it. There was one that I found that was investing in tech startups.
Even today, I think we only have about 25 in the whole country, so that's not very surprising to me.
Well, yeah, exactly. And the pitch process was basically pitch. He said no, and I was like, well, that's Australia for me. So I then did, and it's funny when I tell this story, I think not many non-Australians really get it, but I did what every Australian would do in this scenario, and I was like, well, I'm just going to go travel for a bit. So I took 6 weeks off work. I just went backpacking to try to find the answer, you know. And as it turns out, I did. I popped back into London where I'd been living for a few years previously and caught up with some other entrepreneur friends. And they gave me an inspiration, which was, look, you've got this kind of social shopping site that's a B2C proposition, but how about if you make it into a white label version of that website and license it to other websites. So essentially make it into a B2B proposition. And by the way, I've got a potential website, a wedding website that might be a good first client. And I've also got these people that might give you free desk space if you, like as an accelerator. So I'm like on holidays, I'm wearing flip-flops and shorts, you know. So suddenly I'm having to borrow a friend's clothes to go to a business meeting. I have to call my developers in Romania and say, hey, we've got 3 days to do a working prototype so I can demo a product that we haven't even built yet. I had to whip out PowerPoint and create a presentation for a product that didn't even exist yet. So I went into this wedding website and pitched a complete fabrication, but they loved it. They loved it. And on the basis of that, they ended up paying me a huge chunk of money up front and a subscription over the rest of the year. And on the basis of that, I was like, wow, it seems like I accidentally have a business. So I remember vividly, it was like August the 18th or something. And within a month, I had gone back to Australia, sold my car, sold my furniture, gave up my apartment, quit my job, said goodbye to my weeping mother, my friends, built the product from scratch, and returned to London to be a full-time penniless entrepreneur at the age of 30.
And what year was, I was going to ask you, what year was that? I don't know if you want to answer that.
10.5 years ago now.
And where was your co-founder all this time?
Well, so it was just me for the first couple of years.
Okay, and so were you
Skimlinks
at that point, or were you still Skimbit?
No, so that was just how we became Skimbit, and then and it was just me on my own, and so I was out there trying to then get other clients like this wedding website to license this technology, and I was out there pitching every day and every day being told no. This was now 2008 now, and the world's starting to slide into global recession, and I'm starting to realize, shit, if it's like this hard to get money early on, it's going to get harder and harder. So I started thinking about other revenue models, and I was just constantly tweaking and refining my business, because every time I would pitch to an investor, I kind of saw it as free management consulting advice, which was a nice way of handling rejection. And so I would take that advice, pivot. And then the big pivot came when I brought in my friend from university, Joe. who was doing his own business doing internet marketing stuff. And I was like, look, I need help. I need another revenue model. Can you help me come up with something? So together we came up with this other form of monetization, because people were using our site to bookmark products that they wanted to buy from other retailers. And a lot of these other retailers had affiliate programs, which is where you get paid a commission for referring a sale. But the problem is, to make affiliate links was still an entirely manual process. You know, you had to sign up for all these different affiliate networks, of which there were many. You then have to sign up for each retailer's affiliate program, wait to be approved. Then you'd have to manually construct these like affiliated deep links, which were often very technical and very error prone. Then you'd have to manually paste them into your site and keep them updated, and then log into loads of different interfaces to aggregate your performance. And so what I was discovering is that no one outside of coupon code or deal sites were bothering with affiliate marketing as a publisher, as a content creator. And so we, for ourselves, just invented our own way of automatically monetizing our user-generated content using affiliate marketing. And I found that when I was pitching to investors or to potential customers this great new social shopping site, more of them were interested in this like unsexy way that we were making money than in the actual social shopping functionality. And so it was in like the depths of 2008 that I realized I'm about to run out of money. I've been doing this for 2 years. I'm sick of being penniless and stressed and lonely. So I asked Joe to be my co-founder, and we pivoted the business again, and we dumped everything I'd done for the last 2 years and instead made this monetization technology that we built for ourselves able to run on other websites. So it was suddenly a way that other websites could monetize their own content using affiliate marketing. And amazingly, oh, go on, sorry.
I was going to say, and how did you feel about dumping everything that you had done? What was that like as a sensation?
You know, it's funny, people ask that as if it was a hard decision that was very traumatic, but you have to understand that at this point in time, I'm in survival mode. I'm on adrenaline fuel, can't sleep at night, desperate to do anything. I mean, at that stage, I probably would have done anything to survive. And if it meant dumping 2 years of stuff, it just didn't even... I don't think it even registered at the time. It was like, obviously, this is the thing that I need to do. And it worked. Like, I was able to go back to every single one of the other publishers that I'd been pitching the social shopping functionality to and said, hey, remember me? You hated what I was selling you before, but how about this, which actually just makes you money and it's really easy. And to my delight, a ton of people said yes. I went back to all the investors that had said no to me and said, hey, I'm back. I'm now doing this instead of that. Do you like this? And by the way, we've got a ton of clients already and we're making money already. And I said, yeah, here's the money. So we ended up closing our seed round. After a year of trying, we closed our seed round in record time, and we were like the only deal being done. This is the day after Lehman Brothers collapsed. And we were like the only deal being done in the world, probably at the worst point in the recession. So yes, from the jaws of death, we were saved.
I want to say that displays a remarkable amount of resilience to be able to kind of pull up from that and turn around and just go, okay, well, that didn't work. We're going to start over.
I mean, yes. And it's very easy to kind of mythologize it in retrospect, but at the time, you know, I'm a product person by background. So my job, you know, what comes instinctively is talk to customers. Do they like what I'm doing? If they don't, tweak it. Do you like this now? No, then tweak it. And so to me, it just felt like a very natural process of testing the market and finding what worked and iterating until I did.
And so, look, I was going to ask you what your vision for SkimLinks was back when you started it. But maybe what I want to ask you was, did you actually have a vision for SkimLinks back when you started it, or were you just in survival mode, and did that vision really evolve after you got out of survival mode and had time to think about what was going to come next?
Well, I mean, I think that in the end, they're two very, very different businesses. So when I first started the company, it was like, it was meant to be the, you know, a Pinterest type solution. So my vision at the time was making decisions, group decisions, easy. But now we're a completely different company. Now we're all about helping publishers make money from their content in ways that are not annoying. And that's our vision back then, and it's still our vision today.
And does that answer the question, what does SkimLinks do?
Yes, I can answer that in all sorts of techie or non-techie ways, but at its most basic, yeah, we help publishers like BuzzFeed and Condé Nast and the New York Times, etc., help them get paid for the products that they write about without having to use annoying ads or interrupt the user experience. And so, yeah, we're used now on 4.5 million websites around the world. A billion users a month visit websites that we work with. We drive about $1 billion worth of e-commerce sales through our platform every year. For the more techie people, what we do is we automate affiliate marketing for publishers so that they get the revenue and they get the insights on the buying behaviors of their readers, which they then can use to influence what they write about.
Now, I want to come back in a moment to your clients and your ideal clients, but before we do that, I just want to stay with the early days of SkimLinks for a moment. And I wonder if you could just kind of describe a typical day in the life of Alicia Navarro back around that time when Lehman Brothers was collapsing and you were doing the pivot and you were going out and pitching people who'd said no in the past. You know, what did that typical day look like for you if there was one?
Do you know, in retrospect, they were some of my favorite days because you do whatever it takes. So there was no clear, this is my role, this is your role. Yeah. There was a group of us, and by this stage I had about 4 people in the company, and we did whatever was needed to get things forward. You know, some people were engineers, so they were obviously better at engineering, and I was better at selling, but the truth of it was any of us would have done anything that was needed. And so every day, you know, there was no meetings, there was no, you know, none of this natural stuff that comes to become a bigger company. In those early days, you have a goal, which is to survive, and to build a product that works, that doesn't accidentally take your customer's site down. And that's easy in that, you know, somehow other people want to use as well. So I'd wake up, I mean, I was doing everything. I was doing all the selling, all the investor management, all the marketing, all the copywriting for the website, for the documentation. I was speaking, pitching, working with the engineers on product. It was whatever it took.
And tell me about your early clients. I mean, we alluded to this before when you said that you went, you know, back and talked to people who said no once already. Tell me a little bit about how you went about actually getting those early clients.
I think it's a really interesting thing because, it was a little, what I was selling was very easy to sell because no one had to pay me money. You know, yeah. I made you money. You basically had to say yes and then do nothing else differently and you would earn extra money. So as far as product that you sell goes, it was a really easy sell. However, you did have to install us on your site. Now, if you're the Telegraph, for example, and you're installing SkimLinks on your site, that's a big ask because we could, we're a young company with young engineers and we could bring your site down. And we did once, you know, so that was hard. But the way that I did it was, and this became a really core mantra for SkimLinks as a whole, is that you're not just selling your product, you're selling yourself. And I don't mean that in a prostitute kind of way. I mean that in a, like people are buying into you and the faith that they have in you. So I just poured every bit of sincerity and earnestness and passion into every pitch that I did so that they were like, Jesus, we're going to give this person a chance because you can't say no to her. and what was interesting as well is I often became very, very close friends with my early clients because they weren't just my clients. They were people that were like, oh, let's give her a shot. And to this day, I've gone to weddings of my early clients. I, you know, hang out with my early clients. They become very close friends. But what they also do then is that they also then introduce you to other people. So if they like you and you say, look, do you know anyone else? Generally, they would know other people within their space. And so that was how we got a lot of our early clients. Also, and this is kind of an interesting point for people based outside the US, I was based in London at the time, and the great thing about London or the UK, well, London, is that everyone is based in London. So I was able to, for the price of, you know, a weekly tube pass, be able to physically visit every single one of my clients and sit in front of them and have them look into my eyes and see that I was not ever going to let them down. And so I was able to win those early clients because it was affordable to do face-to-face meetings. And what I was then able to do is leverage and say, look, hey, Hearst Publishing, I'm glad that you love us. Would you mind introducing us to your US parent company? And so I then would talk to the US company and say, hey, we're already running on your UK sites. How about you work with us? And so it became actually very easy for us to expand into the US using that strategy. And within probably the first 6 months, more than 50% of our business was already in the US.
Right. So that's a great segue into what I wanted to ask you about next, which was, when did you decide to take SkimLinks international? So it sounds like it might have been after about 6 months.
I mean, it was immediate. The thing with SkimLinks particularly is that it wasn't a geographically based company. On day one, we could have supported, I mean, you can sign up for us on the website and we would work irrespective of where you were based. So we had our first bit of really good publicity in a sort of industry magazine, probably a couple of months after we launched. And as a result of that one article, and I remember vividly, it was a page 6 footer article. So it wasn't even a very big article, but it was basically about how the Daily Mail had started using SkimLinks. And as a result of that, we ended up winning a ton of big clients in the US that were huge. They just read about it, went to our website, signed up, and put us live. I mean, they didn't even talk to us before they did that. And so suddenly we're in the US. So I was visiting the US to talk to clients within the first 6 months. And that's, again, the great thing is we didn't have to actually sell to anyone. We just had to kind of say, hey, we're here. You can sign up. Look at all the customers that are already using us. Just sign up on the website and you can make yourself go live at any time. I just, within the first year, I was probably every quarter spending a good chunk of time in the US.
Okay. So we were talking about SkimLinks international expansion, and I wanted to ask, you could be an international company, but was there a moment when it suddenly became very clear that that was the path that you were headed down?
I don't think I ever thought, even on day one, that we were just going to be a UK company. I think the beautiful thing about the internet is that there are no physical goods. Like, our technology, our product is completely intangible and can be complete, you know, signed up for, like, someone could theoretically not even talk to another human being and be based in Antarctica and still use us. So from day one, there was no preconception that we were in any way just a local company. Our market was focused on the English speaking world, and was predicated on the network, the affiliate networks and the retailers that we had integrated. So we did focus on the US and the UK for our primary markets, because they were A, English speaking, B, sizable, and C, were the most sophisticated from a both publishing and affiliate marketing perspective. And eventually we kind of did more across Europe and Asia Pacific, but even to this day, I'd say 75% of our business is across the US and the UK.
So if you just think about the process of that international expansion happening, you started in London by going to existing clients mm-hmm. and getting them to use your product on another continent.
Yep.
Where did it go to from there? When did you suddenly go from having just an office to London to also a location in the States as well?
Yeah, so before we set up physical presence in the US, I used a strategy of pretending I did. So I would schedule sizable, I'd say 4 to 6 week long trips every quarter or so, where I would just go mainly to San Francisco, LA and New York, and just go see existing and potential clients, as well as try to immerse myself in the local scene. My hypothesis was that if I did that regularly enough, they would start to see me as being physically present there. And I think that I learned very quickly that particularly in the US, that was important. The US is perhaps subconsciously quite xenophobic, or consciously, but for the most part, you know, even if they're not consciously so, they have this this xenophobia that that is quite instinctive to them. And so I learned very quickly that while they consider my accent very exotic, you should always position yourself as being a regular here, even if you weren't based there, and that that would make a difference to whether they wanted to do business with you or not. So I did that for probably 2 years. And then in 2010, so 2 years after we started, we set up physical shop. So I think we incorporated in the US before we physically set up, because we needed to for being paid by US suppliers, or rather the partners that we were working with. But in 2010, I physically moved over and we set up an office in San Francisco, and I was based out there for 2.5 years.
Right. And at what point did you kind of think, okay, well, I'm ready now to go back to London and let somebody else run the operation out here?
I didn't think when I started that that would be what would happen. When I moved over, I thought that that was going to be it. And I fell in love with San Francisco. It's a wonderful city. And we hired people. We probably had about 10 or so people in our San Francisco office. And then we had the team back in London that was doing more of the product and R&D side of stuff. And what I was doing was basically going back and forth between the two offices every month. Now, I don't know if you've done that trip, but doing that flight every 3 weeks for 2.5 years, it started to really wear on me, both sort of physically and mentally. And also the London office was getting bigger and bigger in terms of its people, and it became really challenging to lead via a crappy Skype connection, you know, especially with when the kind of leader I am is a very in-person, gregarious, warm one. Being remote and not being able to physically, you know, be there for the people that I was trying to communicate with, was taking its toll also on our interpersonal relationships within the team.
Yeah.
So by that stage, I realized, you know, we've got a really solid team of people in the San Francisco office. They don't need me there. And maybe what I it's time that I go back to London. So with a heavy heart, because by that stage, I really loved San Francisco. I moved back to London and I still was traveling to the US regularly, but by inverting that, it took a lot of the pressure off me. So I moved back in at the beginning of 2013.
Yeah. From the outside, the Skimlink story is, I would have to say, I find it a very glamorous story. But as an entrepreneur, I know that, you know, when you go about building a company, there are usually some tough times that happen as well. I was wondering if you could just give me an insight into one of the challenging times that you faced as you grew the business from the UK to the US and beyond that, and how you dealt with whatever that challenge was.
I mean, there's so many, I think. God, there's so many. I think the problem is that there's so many that how do you pick one? And two, you end up internalizing it so much that you stop even remembering them as particularly traumatic, because your kind of general level of stress just gets so high that it becomes normal. I described it recently like going into a Bikram yoga studio. You know, when you first walk in, really smelly, but then within about 10 minutes, you don't smell it because you get used to it. That's what it's like.
Kind of like the frog in the boiling water.
Right, yeah. So you just get used to it. I think that I was noticing that I was taking like a lot of time off. The day after I would come back from a US trip, I just wouldn't be able to get out of bed. And I beat myself up because, you know, what a wuss, you know, I was so weak. but I just physically couldn't. I was just drained mentally and physically. And that was starting to take its toll. And I was lonely. You know, it's really hard to get, you know, have relationships or even like develop friendships properly when you're not guaranteed to be around all the time and you spend a lot of time recovering and unpacking or packing. So that was kind of the hard thing, like handling your own kind of personal and physical challenges while also trying to run a company and deal with competitors and industry challenges and so on. Moving back to London was a good thing. What we also then did is realize that San Francisco was the wrong place for us to have a US base as a UK headquartered company. You know, it was 8 hours time zone difference away. It was a 13 hour flight. And actually there weren't that many of our clients actually based in San Francisco. Most of them were in New York. So around 2015, we made the decision to move our US base from San Francisco to New York. Which made a ton of sense. And frankly, if I could have done it all again, we should have just been based in New York the whole time. And that was really hard because we had an incredible team of people in San Francisco who we offered to, you know, relocate to New York. But they were all Californians. They didn't want to. And so it was really hard to let go of a few people that were my friends and family by that stage. But it was done very amicably and they understood. And so now our New York office has 10 people and is growing and is a much, much more logical place for us to be based. The team there are out all the time visiting clients, talking to them. It's a much shorter time zone difference away. You can pop into New York even for a day if you want to, and it doesn't hurt you physically as much. It's very easy to collaborate. It's only 5 hours time zone difference away, and those extra 3 hours make a world of difference. So I think my big lesson was, you know, think long and hard about where you have your base, because while there is some places have a certain glamour about them, San Francisco being one of them, the practicalities will play a bigger role later on, and that was a big lesson.
I think that's a great example. Now, you were mentioning your team in New York getting out and seeing Skimlink's clients. Who are those ideal clients for you these days, and how do you go about figuring out who those people are?
So our main clients are publishers, so large media companies or content creators. So most of the big newspapers, the big content networks like Condé Nast, Hearst, Time Inc., the big digital natives like BuzzFeed, AOL, Business Insider, and then like a long tail of kind of smaller sites, content creation platforms, forums, etc. So really any content creator that that is talking about products or shopping in some way, naturally within the editorial content, is a client. Or can be a client.
Okay. And to look at the flip side of that, as I understand it, you don't have very many competitors in your space, but the ones that you do have are extremely large. What's your strategy for staying ahead of those competitors?
Well, they're not. Like, I think in terms of direct competitors that do exactly the same thing as us, there's like two, and we're certainly the biggest and have the best roster of customers. In terms of sort of indirect competitors, you could argue Amazon is, but Amazon's also a client. So the biggest competitor, I guess, is what we find is that when publishers become very successful using us and we start to deliver to them a significant amount of revenue, sometimes, like, to get to that level of revenue, they have developed a degree of sophistication around their content creation and sort of internal operations, and they start to think that they don't need us because they can do it themselves. And so that ends up being the biggest competitor, which is how do we make sure that we deliver enough value and save them enough money that they continue using us rather than build their own internal operations to do it themselves.
I like it. Tell me a little bit about the company culture. What is it and how do you do it?
So it began very organically. So, you know, when I first started hiring people, my early employees, I knew that we'd be working really hard and long hours. So you wanted someone that you just kind of got along with and that would have no ego and just be willing to dive in and do whatever it took. So, you know, I hired people that, and by the way, we had no money, so we couldn't hire experienced people. You had to hire people that would be willing to learn and willing to help each other out and that would keep things light even when things were in a dark place. And those things became the kernels of our culture, sort of learning, helping each other out, taking care of each other and laughing along the way. And over the years, as we got bigger, that started to codify itself by what we called skim love, which became, was a very tacky and silly thing. We just had this silly habit of prefixing everything with the word skim. So we didn't have intern and skim turns. We didn't have football. We played skim ball, you know. And so skim love or hashtag skim love became the way that we would congratulate each other via our internal comms, like Yammer back then and then Slack. When we congratulated each other on winning a client because of who we were and because we went out and went beyond, above and beyond what was required to get something done or to help a colleague out. And so very organically, the team would use hashtag skim love as a way to signify that someone had used their heart, themselves, their passion to do something or win something. And so that kind of very weirdly and naturally evolved into being our culture. And then as the years progressed, I recognized that it was time to kind of codify it a little bit more officially. And I ended up deconstructing the letters so that they would reflect the values that were present across everyone that we looked for. So S was sparkle, you know, that fire in the eyes. K was kick ass. Are they just really talented and hardworking? I was inventive. Do they love solving problems? M is master their domain. Do they take initiative? Do they do whatever it takes to get something done? L was likable. We don't like to hire dicks. O is open-minded because I'm a female leader. We've got lesbian. We've got age. We've got, you know, are you open-minded enough and to appreciate diversity? V is vocal. Can you stand up and say, hey, I don't agree, or hey, I've got a better idea? That's always been really encouraged. And then E is entrepreneurial. Do you just love being part of this journey and love the process of building something with a group of people? And so we ended up then codifying it again even further by creating neon letter hashtag and hanging it on our kitchen. And in fact, now even when you walk into our office, you don't see our company name. You see our culture name in neon letters as you walk in, because that's how core to who we are it is. And what we've then, you know, you continue to codify that even further. That becomes what you look for when you hire. It becomes the values that you rate people on during, you know, performance reviews. It becomes the awards that we give. So every Friday night we give a kick-ass award. And it becomes a very, a much more codified process to instill it into the culture and into how we hire and into how we reward or what we punish. But it's an incredibly important thing. And these days culture is a much more popular concept than it used to be. But back then it was, you know, I felt like I was the only one talking about it. And it's been really exciting to see that some of the early ideas and mantras that we kind of lived by have become a lot more adopted, at least across the kind of London startup scene.
That is very cool. And I would love it if you could send me a picture of those neon letters so that I can include them in the email that will go out about this interview when we publish it a little while from now. I'd love to see that. Now, just on you as a female leader, because one of the reasons that I have got you on the podcast chatting to me right now is that we are currently running the Girls Going Global campaign. And one thing that I am really trying to do is to highlight female entrepreneurs who have made an international success of their business to demonstrate to other people just how possible it is. Do you think it would be fair to say that your industry is pretty male dominated? And do you think that as you've gone on this international journey, being female has been a help to you, or has it been a hindrance?
Okay, I don't think it's male dominated. It just is male populated. You know, I think, and I can only speak about my own industry because that's the only one I know very well. But I don't think it's. I feel it's very much a meritocracy, and that if you're good enough, you're good enough, whether you're male or female. People just love people that are good and geeky and love what they do. It just happens to be that a lot of people that are good and geeky and love technology happen to be men, but they haven't, there's never been, and I can honestly say this, been any hindrance or any disadvantage whatsoever with being a female in this industry. I topped my computer science degree. I've worked all my life. I'm almost always the only woman in the room, and I've never been treated with anything other than respect. And given, if anything, advantages rather than any kind of disadvantage because of my gender. I'm remembered a lot more. People, you know, it's much easier to approach people. I get a lot of help if I ask for it. It's been a boon in every single way. And I think it's because I know my stuff and I can hold my own. I've never even felt particularly that I'm a woman in the space because I just happen to be a woman. And I'm very mindful of what my strengths and weaknesses are. Some of my strengths are attributes that generally pertain.
You were just saying that your strengths were.
Yes, I recognize what my strengths are and what my weaknesses are. And as with anything, I work to optimize my strengths and mitigate my weaknesses. So I think the things that make me good at what I do are that I'm very empathetic. I'm very warm and gregarious. I'm able to get people enthused and get people to trust me. Now, you could argue, you know, is that a gender-specific thing? I don't know, but they are the things that I'm good at, and I optimize towards those in the work that I do. There are things that I'm not good at. I'm not very good at the sort of financial management or operational management. So I hire a team of executives that are brilliant operators, executors, and financiers, and we work fantastically together. This is what it means about being open-minded. You know, I believe in creating diverse teams, but for me, diverse means a lot more than just gender. It means having people that have different strengths and weaknesses around you so that together you become super uber human type. And that's, you know, being a female has never been an issue for me. Now, I presume that there are other industries that are a lot more endemic in their sort of sexism, perhaps media, banking might be a lot worse, but technology, if you're good enough, you're good enough. But honestly, that's been my experience.
I would love to get you to, you might, I don't know if you know her, but Dr. Katrina Wallace from Flamingo, who works in the AI space. I would love to get you and her together at some point to actually talk more around this topic. But look, for now, we are starting to run short on time, I know. And so I wanted to make sure I got in a couple of questions around favorite books or people who have inspired you on the journey. And I was wondering if you could tell me who or what are they and why.
I'd say probably my favorite book that was so powerful I wept like 5 times while reading it is The Hard Thing About Hard Things by Marc Andreessen. He's the guy that started Andreessen Horowitz and was the guy that started Netscape and a few other things. But if you're a tech entrepreneur, I mean, I don't even know anyone in the tech industry that hasn't read it, but if you are at all interested in tech or entrepreneurship, it's an absolute must read. It is brilliant and moving and inspiring, and you just sit there going, yes, this is what I'm going through. So that is a wonderful book. And what it inspired me, it talks all about the yearning and the struggle that you go through and how lonely it is. And I think it was just so joyful to read that someone else was going through exactly what I was going through, and they conquered and survived.
That's pretty cool. How can people get in touch with you if they would like to know more about what you do, or if they just like to become a fan?
I'm on LinkedIn, which is a useful tool. So yeah, Alethea Navarro, Skin Links. Or by the website, I think is a nice way to get in contact with me.
And do you have any final thoughts, particularly for female entrepreneurs who are listening to this conversation and thinking about getting out there and taking on the world?
I think that my advice, and take this with a grain of salt, is if you focus too much on your gender, other people will as well. And I'm sure you're the same with this, Cynthia, that the reason that we've been successful is because being a woman is just one of our many things that define us, and certainly not the only or first thing. I define myself much more as an entrepreneur, as a passionate person, as a warm person. The fact that I don't have a penis is kind of, much further down the list of things. And I think that if you go into business with that as a chip on your shoulder, you're setting yourself up for failure. And instead, what you need to do is be honest about your strengths and weaknesses and set things up around you so you optimize for your strengths and you mitigate your weaknesses rather than expect others to mitigate them on your behalf.
Yeah, look, I think that is very true. But I am often surprised by how much this gender question comes up. I will give you an example. Today, I saw a post on LinkedIn where somebody had tagged me and commented that the words founder and entrepreneur were very infrequently used on female profiles on LinkedIn. And they asked me for a view on this. And I was kind of confused because my profile says founder, but it doesn't say entrepreneur. And my reaction was, well, what is wrong with those words? And the person wrote back and said, well, nothing's wrong with them. But apparently most women, I don't know, maybe they don't feel confident, or for whatever reason, they don't put them down. I was just shocked because it never occurred to me. I mean, it's never occurred to me one way or the other that there's anything I can or can't write on my profile. I just consider, okay, well, that's just a factual description of what I do. Why would I shy away from that? So look, I'm with you. It's never really occurred to me that I could or couldn't do anything because of my gender. But nonetheless, it's, we do see in certain industries that it still continues to hold people back, either for reasons that are real or because they believe that because of their gender, there is something that they can't do.
That's possible, and maybe podcasts like this will go some way to show women that there's not that much different between people that have done it and those that haven't, other than they've just chosen to do it. So if you it's about helping women understand that they can aspire to this, that it's a great life. Hard life, but it's an interesting one, and that to achieve it, it takes hard work, perseverance, and passion. But it's possible. You just have to do it. And I do think a lot of women tend to hold themselves back. And I found actually when I was living in Australia that was possibly a bigger problem there. I think that there might be more subconscious gender bias in Australia. I certainly felt it when I go back. Even as an Australian, when I go back, I'm a lot more aware of it because I'm a foreigner now, in a way. So I think, maybe spend some time traveling and remind yourself that there are other ways of being.
Because people can't see this and it's an audio recording, they won't know that I'm actually nodding my head. All right. We are pretty much out of time. I just want to say a huge thank you for coming on the show. I know people are going to love this interview, and I know that it's going to be really inspiring for a whole range of women who are either already on the international journey, just getting started, or thinking about it. And I'd love to have you back on the show sometime to see where you've gone to next.
I'd love to go back. I miss home. Thanks, Cynthia.
Hey, everyone. If you're enjoying the Business Beyond Borders podcast and you're thinking about expanding your company internationally, you might want to check out the International Business Accelerator, which is something I created to help micro to medium-sized businesses to speed up and de-risk the process of internationalization. The International Business Accelerator, or as we like to call it, the IBA, is a program built on the three principles of skills and knowledge, mentoring and accountability, and community. I built it especially for founders and CEOs who want to take their business to the next level and are wondering where to start. The program is structured in a way that's simple to follow. It's digital, so you can take part from anywhere in the world. It's a lot of fun and our members love it. So if that's you, if you're thinking about going global, check it out at internationalbusinessaccelerator.com.